I'm Shalina Tobin, aka Posh Nosh Girl, and today I'm joined by the highly talented chef and restaurateur, Andy Waugh. From humble beginnings in the beautiful Scottish Highlands, Andy's become iconic for his legendary award-winning meat and burgers at his restaurant chain, Mac and Wild. His portfolio also includes innovative food and drink experiences, and from his butcher's outlets, he supplies some of the best produce available in the UK today. Hi Andy, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm good, thank you.
And how's life been in lockdown?
To be honest, it's been a slightly welcome change of pace, but I've got two young kids, so one of them's three, Iona, who's great and chatty. Another one, Angus, is 11 months. In fact, his birthday is next week, so he's going to be one next week. But it's been nice to be around them a lot more. Angus took his first steps a few weeks ago.
Oh, nice. That must be really nice to be around for it.
Yeah, and I definitely feel much more of a family unit. So it's good. But obviously, it's been a bit tough with closing the restaurants and, you know, working out who we are, what we stand for, how we can have a viable business during this time and look after the future of Mac and Wild and our staff as well.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that a little bit later on. I just wanted to start at the beginning with you. So you grew up near Inverness in Scotland. What was life like for you there?
At the time I didn't really appreciate it. I think as all kids do or don't, as the case may be. But it's a very different environment to England, particularly. But it's just such a sparsely populated area. So we had my mum and dad live in this amazing old cottage, pretty knackered, on the side of this huge kind of, it's called a kyle, where the river and the sea meet, this massive expanse of water. And then behind us are hills and nothing very much other than lots of deer and wildlife roaming around. So our kind of holidays always were in Scotland. My mum and dad love, you know, the outdoors and food particularly, and fishing. My dad is a massive keen fisherman. So everything was kind of focused around fishing for stuff. So whether it was an island on the west coast or on this River Spey or whatever it would be, we stayed in these amazing houses. But yeah, I just wanted to go to France or Tenerife, just like everyone else. It was an amazing childhood, and it's what I sort of want for my kids now. Now we're based in London, slightly different, kind of experience for them.
Yeah, and do you have a favourite childhood memory from back then? Was it fishing or?
What a favourite! Yeah, actually, my first fish that I caught, I think I would have been about, I don't know, 3 years old or something. And I'd gone up, my dad was fishing on the river, and I went up to visit him at the end of the day, and I had a bamboo cane, so a cane of bamboo with a tied some fishing line on the end. And I sat there like a gnome, just holding my thing. And I didn't catch anything, obviously. But he said, look, let's go back to the house and we'll just leave. We planted my rod into the side of the bank, and we said, we'll come back in the morning and see what's on there.
Right.
And we came back in the morning, and lo and behold, there was a huge trout, or I can't remember, maybe even a salmon on the end of it. It's obviously been there a while. And I was absolutely chuffed. And from that day, I loved fishing, I've always loved it. I love being outside and just that kind of the thrill of it. But genuinely, this is about a year or two ago. So I'm 37. So 2 years ago, my dad had told me that he'd actually gone up in the morning, caught a fish, and then put it on the end of my line. And all of a sudden, I felt like, it's like, geez, my whole life is
life has changed. You never caught the fish.
there was that. Like, we used to, so I, salmon is obviously a product that's synonymous with Scotland. But I grew up eating wild salmon caught from the river. And now they've got this different product that's farmed and much more fatty. And but yeah, we just ate really good foods our whole life. It was amazing. My mum's an amazing cook. And we were all very keen eaters as kids.
Yeah. So you said somewhere that you ate meat for breakfast, lunch and dinner. Is that right?
Yeah, there was always meat on the table because we genuinely didn't have very much money. But we lived like gods, like kings, and just in the sense that our dinner table was always stacked and our fridge was always full. But yeah, always, because venison was, that's what my family do. So they're game dealers. So they butcher wild meat. And right. So we always had a fridge or a freezer full of venison or rabbits or pheasants or whatever the case may be. Right. Yeah, it was just, yeah, it's a good source of protein. It's healthy. It's natural. Yeah. It's what we should be eating. Yeah. So yeah, mum and dad were quite enthusiastic about us eating plenty. Yeah. So I'm 6'3", and my brother's about the same size, so it's obviously help for something.
Yeah, absolutely. And along with fishing, did you also go hunting as well?
Yeah, did a bit of that. I was given a gun on my birthday, that's my day of birth, it makes me sound like an avid, like, shooting, hunting killer, But no, like it's not about that for me. It's not about going out and shooting hundreds of animals. I love to go out and for me I would be happy not catching when fishing. It's not about catching the fish. It's not about shooting. It's just about being outside. Yeah. And I just love being out in the hill or, you know, in the peace and quiet or with nature. It's just good for me. But yeah, we did a bit of shooting, like with deer or birds, and it was mostly rough shoots. So.
Right.
We'd go and just go out and shoot what we found, and then generally eat it or sell them to my dad for a couple of quid to buy some sweets or something like that. So.
Oh, brilliant! So after your childhood, you went to university. What did you study there?
So I studied biology at Edinburgh Uni, and that was purely just because I had a very sciencey upbringing. My mum was the first female forensic scientist in Scotland.
Oh wow!
So she kind of pushed that on to us kids a little bit, and then growing up in my family are butchers, so growing up with these kind of carcasses hanging around, you soon get to understand how they work, and pull, you know, you could pull tendons and you'd see things move. So I was interested by it, and so yeah, I wanted to study biology.
Right, and that's very different to where you are now. So what was it that brought you to London?
My girlfriend at the time got onto a master's at, doing broadcast journalism. So she got a master's at in Glasgow or Westminster. So we decided, we looked at the weather forecast and said, which one's got better weather, Glasgow? No. But we just, all of our friends were, had moved to London, and just thought, let's have a change. So my then girlfriend is now my wife and mother to my lovely kids. So yeah, it was a good choice. I'm glad that we did it. And yeah, instantly, was absolutely kind of charmed by the city and everything that goes on there and the food. I just remember walking down the street, and I think it was even like the Tesco, and going to Tesco and being like, what the hell is this? What is this thing? And like all these weird and wonderful vegetables, and the culture is just such a smash of, you know, of everyone. And yeah, I just was massively blown over by the whole vibe of the city and the food and the drink and people.
Right, and so you set up a market stall called Wild Game Company. Were you travelling back and forth to Scotland still?
No, I went. I did it a couple of times, but it's about 12. Or I think if you drive door to door, it's 12 hours from London to my family place. So did it a couple of times. Just the fuel costs alone were not really worth it. So I set up a kind of a network going from there down to London.
And so was that your initial plan to set up the market stall when you actually came into London?
No, not at all. I always thought I would do something in game and in venison and, you know, start my own business. I always had this kind of idea of that for some reason, just under, you know, the back of my mind. And I didn't realize how to start it. And until I discovered, I went on a cycle ride and just happened to bump into Broadway Market in East London. And yeah, again, I had another kind of falling in love moment, and it just sort of parked my bike, walked up through this market where you could buy a guitar, you could get a bike, you could buy amazing meat, you could get cheese, wine, and everyone there was so trendy and like it was just like wow, what is this place? Kind of epitomized that kind of London kind of vibe, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I just bumped into the organizers and I said, "What, you know, what's the deal here? Can I start a stall?" And they said, "Well, what do you do?" And I had to make up on the spot. I had to just, you know, when you're forced to decide something. And I just said, "Oh, I've got a game business." And I obviously didn't. I had a family business that did it. So, and they said, "Okay, well, when can you start?" We had a guy here who's he's gone. When can you start? And I said, "Well, I don't know, two weeks." And so I quit my job on Monday and then went back home, bought myself a van, bought a few hundred quid's worth of meat off my dad and shot back down to London.
Wow. That is quite some story.
I wish it was a bit more. Do you know what? That was the kind of shorthand version of it. But there were a few moments when I'd been to other markets and it all started to make sense, the whole what I wanted to do. And I went to Borough Market and was really angry at the quality of food that was there,
right?
Or quality of game particularly, and because I remember being really homesick at the beginning when I had arrived, and I just saw that, you know, the big banners that it said game and something or other, meat and game or whatever it said, and I thought, oh, you know, I'm going to go and have a talk with this guy, and we're going to talk meat, we're going to talk venison, we're going to talk whatever, rabbits, and it's going to be okay. And anyway, I walked up and I just saw this really mangy looking rabbit for about £10 or something. And then all of a sudden, it's quite nice you touched upon the university, like all my friends at uni had never tasted venison. Like a lot of them didn't know what it was. And I said, yeah, well, how can you not taste it? As you mentioned earlier, breakfast, lunch and dinner, we used to eat venison.
Yeah.
So that's where the kind of journey started, I suppose, at uni. But then when I saw this product at Borough, I was just like, wow, that's why people don't eat it. And when they do eat it, they think it tastes gamey or like rich or whatever the terms that people have are. And I was used to this, you know, succulent, fresh, you know, nicely hung product. And then I saw it and I went, that's why no one buys it again. That's why only people that know about it buy it. So yeah, those two moments when I went to Borough,
right,
and the Broadway, and I was like, this is it, this is what I've got to do.
And it was amazing because you had a fridge in your van or a freezer in your van where you bought all the meat back.
So I had a serve over counter, and so I bought a little refrigerated counter. It was I don't know if it was 1.5 or 1.2 meters wide. So I had to pick that and put it in the back of the van. And I also bought myself a freezer, a domestic freezer that fit in the back of the van. And I used to use that. I used to try and park it as close as I could to my house, put in a line going into my living room window. So I'd turn the freezer on and I have 2 liter bottles of ice or water, 2 liter bottles of water, and then freeze everything down for a couple of days. And then I use that as my kind of working fridge. I mean, it's such a cowboy thing to do, but it's just it's what I did.
Well, it's quite innovative.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I didn't have the luxury of, you know, any money behind me. And I didn't have the savings or anything to go and get myself a premises. So
yeah.
I didn't want to pay, you know, whatever it would be, like 50 or 100 quid a week for you know, a storage or whatever, so I just use my van.
Yeah, well, it's a clever idea. And I mean, in 2012 you were winning awards, best street food trader and trader of the year. That was amazing from where you've come to there.
Yeah, that was a really special moment. It actually came up on my Facebook kind of, whatever it's called, like time loop or feed, or popped up the other day. It was a really, I'll always remember that day and never forget it. And I felt like such an underdog. And I think we were making excuses. I was talking to my mate Roo, who was running business with me at the time. And we were already making excuses when we went to this award ceremony, and we're like, I think there was like four or five people in the, up for the award. And yeah, we were just joking about how, you know, I don't know, I can't remember. And then he said our name, and I was like, no way, this is hilarious. I think it was a Tuesday. And then we went out and got really drunk and said, don't worry, we don't need to go to the market tomorrow. And then I was like, we need to go to the markets. I can't wait to go to the market tomorrow. So we both had a stonking hangover. But yeah, it was a really satisfying time. And that was the moment where I thought, shit, I need to do something with this. This is, there's more to what's going on. People really are buying into it. They appreciate the messages that we've got and the produce.
And so how did Mac and Wild come about?
So yeah, so after I'd won the awards that you were just discussing, the Young British Foodies, yeah. I remember my first pop-up, and I remember walking into the room and seeing people eating my family's, the venison that I'd bought from my dad's business sort of thing, and everyone was going, like, you know, when they don't actually say anything, and there was 60 people in this pie and mash shop. And that was the moment where I really was like, I need, this is what I want to do. And I was trying to get a restaurant. I had no idea on how to do that. I was just ringing up all sorts of people trying to get my foot in the door. And there was huge deposits and business plans and things that I just didn't really have. And then I bumped into my old friend, Callum McKinnon. So he just moved to London, sold his two or three bars and clubs. And he was just asking what I was up to, and I said, well, I'm trying to open a restaurant. And he said, oh, that sounds cool. Do you want a hand? So we sort of formulated the idea of Mac and Wild, and it was, you know, with the kind of the dirty street food, and then some sort of nice cuts of steak and stuff like that. And we got it together, and we saved up, managed to all the money I'd saved up and a little bit of his cash to open our pop-up on Charlotte Street. So that was our first kind of Mac and Wild pop-up, and that let us demonstrate to landlords, you know, it was a full-time restaurant. I think I had about 18 covers. Was it 18? Yeah. But it was, we painted the walls and made it feel, yeah, kind of Mac and Wild-esque. Yeah. And we could demonstrate what we're about. And had lots of learning points, but it was a success, yeah. So that was the first one.
Hey? Oh, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say that was 2000, and I think it was 15 or 14, no, 14 we did that. 2014. 14. Yeah, and then...
Mac and Wild opened in Fitzrovia in 2015, and your second one came soon after in the city, but we'll talk more about that one later. But you went from serving on a stall to having a big team of people. Did that require a new set of leadership skills?
I think it required a new kind of approach to how I spent my time, where I spent my time. And really looking at what our core values were and what it is that we were trying to get across. And dealing with, you know, we had like 10 chefs and, 50, I don't know what, I can't remember what it was in the beginning, but yeah, dealing with all these people and making sure that they were happy and the produce was good and the reviews were great. Yeah, it was a challenge. And I remember there's so much focus goes on into like when you open. You know, you're at a date. So I think we opened on the 6th of or 5th of August, 2015 was the first official opening. And there was so much focus on just getting the restaurant ready, getting the team in, getting everything, you know, getting everything prepared. And then I remember waking up on the 6th and being like, Jesus, I've got to do this now. I've actually got to run. I hadn't thought about this stage. I just thought about getting opening. Yeah. So there's a lot of learnings again. I've learned, yeah, how to do things the wrong way probably, or how to do them right way, but by doing them the wrong way. And that experience is definitely valuable now.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you have, your signature dish is the Venimu burger, which is voted the best burger in Britain. Why is it so special?
God, well, you really put yourself on a pedestal when you say it's the best burger in Britain, don't you?
Well, someone else put you on the pedestal, so...
I know. Everyone's got their favourite burger, I suppose. But I love, our Venimu is great. There's a couple of aspects. When you're making a good burger, you need some good flavour combinations, some good textures. And I think the underlying kind of bonus we have above everyone else is our provenance, and more so that we talk about, there's actually a journalist dubbed us, they said they have more than provenance, it's extreme provenance. So we talk about extreme provenance every now and again. And that puts an extra layer of sweetness into the pot products, because we, you know, our venison comes from my family. We can tell you the name of the breed of deer. We tell you where it's from. We tell you the name of the hunter. You can tell the name of the butchers online that day, and more so we can tell you about those people as well. So we can, you know, we generally know where they drink, where their kids go to school, the name of their dog, kind of thing. So that really helped. But yeah, that's, I think it's a there's a venison patty and a beef patty with some caramelized onions, melted cheese, béarnaise, pickles, and a brioche bun. Like, how wrong can you go? I mean, that's delicious.
Well, I'm actually going to find out, because I've got my own.
Yay!
I've got my own kit, and I've also got the brunch kit, which this weekend is going to be full on. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I've got your cloche video as well. Where did that idea come from?
God, it was a bit of a slow kind of process over the years. We had a pretty crappy burger when we first started. It was like just, you know, kind of standard patties that had all sorts of like flavors and rusks and stuff into it. So, and it was just I can't remember. It was a really basic burger. But that, we were sort of around when that burger revolution came on, and just learning a few techniques from other people, and it's just a nice way of steaming the top of the bun. So that's what the whole thing is important to me, because you get that when you put the water around and the cloche on top, the steam goes in and warms the lid and more importantly melts the cheese. So you get this, like, everything just sort of comes together.
I've never seen it before, so I'm going to be trying that this weekend.
I'm not sure I can take full responsibility for inventing that. I think it's definitely a process that wasn't me that came up with, but yeah, a lot of people do it, and it's just a really good way of making a really good burger.
Right. And do you make your own haggis as well?
Yes, we do, but we don't make it commercially. So we buy the haggis in. I host haggis, or used to when we were open, host a haggis making class once a week. So you come, teach you all about what's in it, how to make it. But making haggis is quite a serious process. And for us, because we go through about 100 kilos of the stuff every week.
Wow.
I'm not willing to sit down and make 100 kilos of haggis every week. So we buy it from my local butcher up in the north of Scotland, from Munro's, the butcher, who are one of the award-winning haggis makers. But yeah, I can teach you how to make it.
It's all right. I get a bit squirmish. I just like eating. I'm not into making that kind of stuff.
Well, it's important. It's not about being disgusting or gross. So the whole underlying message behind Mac and Wild is trying to like get that sense of reality, and there is the only difference between eating a liver, heart, and lungs versus eating a fillet steak or a ribeye. It's protein. It comes from an animal that is probably a muscle that has a purpose, like, or an organ. There's very little difference. It's purely cultural, and we seem to have kind of moved away from what the reality of eating meat, and I think it's wrong. And in the time we live, it's such a good time now, because it's people are don't want to waste anything, and they don't want to like just throw away half an animal for, or yeah, most of the animal. Like no one wants anything other than the ribeye, the fillet, the sirloin, maybe the rump, the rest of it, like just put it in the bin. So it doesn't work like that. We've got to respect the animal and the planet. So haggis will save the planet.
Well, I'm convinced, so I'm going to come for one of your classes now.
I'd love to have you there. That'd be great.
So in 2018, you went full circle and you returned to your roots with the Map and Wild Base Camp. Tell us about that.
So Falls of Shin, that is about 6 miles from where I grew up. There was always a cafe, kind of restaurant offering there. It's basically in the middle of a forest along a single track road. So if you're driving one way and another person's coming the other way, one of you has to reverse to a passing place and let them pass, and then you drive on. Right. And it goes, the road sort of shimmies up the side of this river, and it's a famous salmon river for fishing. And people pay lots of money to go fishing there. And then halfway up the river, there's a waterfall, huge, big waterfall. So it's this big kind of point where the poor salmon have to, yeah, make a leap of faith and swim up there somehow. And we're just lucky, just the way that the geography is. And there's a great viewing platform for you to watch the salmon leaping up. So anyway, beside there's a clearing in the forest, and we've built this, well, recently rebuilt the restaurant, because it burned down about 6-7 years ago. And the community bought it and did it and opened it back up. But sadly when it burned down, there was a lot of people employed there, so the community bought it as a way of sort of just, yeah, having a facility, because there's not a lot there.
So the location's beautiful. I've seen images of it. And was it a conscious decision to go there?
I guess my heart has always been pining to go back to the Highlands. And there's a really famous Burns poet, Robert Burns, who's our famous poet from Scotland. And there's a poem that says, "My heart is in the Highlands, my heart is not here." And I kind of always feel like that. I mean, less recently. Now I've got my kids and stuff down here. But the Highlands is always going to be my home. And yeah, it's where my soul kind of wants to rest, I suppose. But it's really nice to gone back and try something up there. And it's been a really tough business exercise to try and, it was maybe a bit arrogant or just inexperienced, shall we say. I thought I could just take Mac and Wild from London and put it into this place in the Highlands, and it's not worked like that. It's been a different kind of customer base, and just a different offering that was needed. So we've had to change things up a fair bit, but the fundamentals are still the same. You know, it's about good produce, sourced very locally there, which is quite easy for us to do. But we've also pivoted into this kind of, we've got a kind of cafe offering where we do, you know, cheesecakes, coffees and like sausage rolls and sort of Mac and Wild classics. And then we've got this fire pit feast supper club that we have every now and again. So it's like kind of five to seven courses cooked on the open flames.
Wow.
Big communal table. I've found myself, like my style and everything of cooking, and has really come out there, and it kind of reflects everything that I love. So we have big, you know, boards of salmon or mackerel or whatever fish we've got kind of sitting against the fire, and well, big cuts of beef, and maybe a pot of langoustine simmering away and vegetables. And it's for me, I just absolutely love cooking like that, because it's so raw. You've got smoke in your face half the time, which is not so fun, but the customer can see what they're eating, and it's not that they're not just celebrating a sexy piece of, you know, tiny bit of fish or meat with some sort of trendy foam and some powder on top. They see it all before it gets to that stage. So they see, and you're like, right, that's what I'm eating, and that's the reality of it.
Right.
It's a really fun communal space. So we do that kind of fire pit feast, and we've got some adventure accommodation in there as well. So we've got some Land Rovers with tents, and we're just looking at putting some really amazing stuff into the forest that surrounds us. So
Wow, that sounds like an amazing experience.
It's a really special place, so definitely recommend people to go there.
There are many elements to the business, including supper clubs, foraging classes, whiskey masterclasses. Are you a blend or a single malt whiskey drinker?
So I would never try and pigeonhole myself as one or the other. Just because, I mean, a single malt is just a blend of whiskey made from the same place. It doesn't mean anything. I do tend to drink probably more single malts, but that's just because I've got access to more of them. But there are some incredible blends out there. So there's one of my favorite whiskies is by a company called Compass Box. So they're a Glasgow-based blender. So they blend whiskies, but they really put a very modern kind of touch on it. And they use really, really like high-end whiskies. So they've got like 40-year-old Coila or whatever goes into it. But they've got one called This Is Not Luxury Whiskey. And so it's got a bottle that's handwritten in a gold pen that says This Is Not Luxury Whiskey. But it's £160 a bottle and it's a blend.
Wow.
So, and it's phenomenal. I wouldn't pigeonhole myself, but yeah, I typically will drink more single malts than blends. However, what I will say to you is we've got a piece of kit that we sell. It's called an infinity bottle. So what you do is you put all the, so I, when you go to tastings, you get given these little bottles of, you know, like 25 or 50 mil bottles of whiskey, and you kind of take them home, and you never, it's rare that you, or rare that I go, do you know what, I'm going to drink that little miniature. So even if you've got bottles of whiskey and you've got like a little bit in the bottom that you're saving and you want to drink it with something special. So what we do is we have an infinity bottle where you pour everything in and you create this, your own blend. They work out pretty good. So if you want to get someone something interesting for as a present, it's a really good gift.
Well, that sounds like a good gift, actually. My husband loves whiskey, and his favourite is Glenmorangie, which I think is near your home, right?
Yeah, so that's where I went to school, in a town called Tain, which is where Glenmorangie is from. I love Glenmorangie. Yeah, it's really good liquid.
So I said we come back to your restaurant in the city. You've got an experience venue there called Smoky Barrels. How does that work?
So Smoky Barrels is a kind of a competitive socializing, virtual hunting kind of experience. So it's basically, I don't know, it depends how old everyone is that's watching this, but there's a game on the Nintendo in the 90s called Duck Hunt. And you'd put a little camera on top of your TV and you get this kind of orange and grey pistol and you shoot ducks that fly across. So it's basically Duck Hunt for adults, because we've got a whiskey bar. We've got about 150 whiskeys in the back bar, cocktails, beers. And you get dressed up in some, we've got all this fancy dress, tweed jackets and hats. And you basically get dressed up and you're with your mates and you do some shooting. So you can shoot pheasants, grouse, deer. We've got a wild haggis hunt as well, so you can shoot haggis. It's very, very competitive and addictive.
Right, well, it sounds like fun.
Yeah, and it's in the basement of the restaurant, so it's really fun. So you can go for a slap-up meal and then take yourself down for some shooting.
Okay. Are you still being waved at?
But it's been good. So we're going to open up a few more of them. We're opening one in America. We're supposed to open up two in America. So that's good. I'll come up in a minute. I'll see once I'm done. Bye. So we've got two Smoky Barrels opening in America. Or we're supposed to have two this year. But I think one's been pushed back till February next year.
Right.
We're looking at other sites around the UK for that. But it's a really, really good fun and been well received. So.
Brilliant. So you have butcher counters in your restaurants. Why do you have that?
It kind of opens up a new customer base, so people can come in and buy their steak to take home. And we wanted to, even before all this kind of COVID thing happened, we wanted people to experience Mac and Wild at home and be able to have access to the kind of quality of ingredients that we have. So the idea was to have this, well, I also went full circle a bit to my old kind of market stall days. So we just put the counters in, and it's actually worked on a kind of secondary level where at night time people go in and they kind of gather around the butcher counter and they say, oh, what's that? Or I want that one. Oh my God, look at that. And they might have come in for a burger and chips, but they go out buying a tomahawk. And, so yeah, it's worked well.
So it must have been a lifesaver during the COVID lockdown, as your home delivery burger kits and your meat cuts are a massive hit as well.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, we very quickly pivoted into this kind of online business, and it's something that we had been talking about for a long time. And it's really interesting when you do as a restaurant, and we talked about what it is we are and or who we are and what we stand for. And we always like to think we're more than a restaurant, but as soon as you remove your main income revenue stream, like, then you really do have to dig deep and say, right, well, actually, like, what are we, and how can we connect with people, and what can we do to help? And luckily we had this, we've got excellent supply on tap and suppliers and producers that are still out, you know, working, and they can't just stop, you know, growing cows, or you can't stop the hunting process that's going on and the sort of management. So we, and the supermarkets were bare. So we just opened up an online butcher.
Fantastic.
And then went into the restaurant kits.
Yeah. Well, they're brilliant, and I can't wait to use mine. So how have you managed to keep your teams motivated during lockdown?
Oh man. So like I've worked harder in the last 8 weeks or 12 weeks than I've ever worked before. It's kind of a 7 a.m. till midnight job, 6 or 7 days a week, or maybe, you know, the weekend I try and take a few hours off. But there's so much to do, and I think right now it's what's on the line is has never been tougher. And if you know, it's the ones that work harder and that I have kind of adapted that will succeed. Most people have been furloughed. We've had a team of about 4 or 5 that have been working really hard on the online, and it has been a challenge. But we've set ourselves some big kind of focuses and to try and achieve. We've done a really good job, but that's because everyone has been working towards the same goals, and that's the survival of Mac and Wild, basically. So there's quite a lot on the line.
So do you see the delivery business being as strong once restaurants reopen again?
I am certain it won't be as strong, no. And we can already see a bit of a tailing off in terms of where people are going back to the supermarkets for their products. And as everyone's sort of adapted and got back into the swing of things. And yeah, I don't think it'll be quite as strong as it was in the crazy days, but it's definitely here to stay for Mac and Wild. We want to really hold on to that, and the future has never been more uncertain. So with the limiting space we're going to have, and as a restaurant, if you're not running at 80% capacity, you're probably losing money, and we're going to need to try and make up some extra revenue elsewhere. So the at-home kits is great because we can reach, instead of just doing, you know, our London inside the M25 or whoever comes to us, we're now reaching every single corner of the UK. So there's potential there.
When things return to normal, do you think that you'll challenge for Michelin stars?
No, Mac and Wild will never be a Michelin restaurant. We're way too much spit and sawdust for that kind of thing. We've got
precedents though. The world famous Michelin starred Noma restaurants in Copenhagen reopened just last month, and they're serving only burgers in their garden.
Really?
Yeah.
No way. So what? So say that again. So they've opened up and they're only serving burgers.
Yeah, they're serving burgers in their garden, and they're world famous for their Michelin stars.
Oh well, bring on this. I'll take 3 then.
Bring it on.
Stars, I've always had a little bit of a pipe dream about having a Michelin starred restaurant one day. I would never say never, but yeah, let's see.
So what can we expect next from you? What new things have you got in the pipeline?
Oh, wow. We've got a couple of really exciting projects that we're working on right now. One of them I can't talk about just yet, but that is, really, really exciting. So I will let you know as and when that opens. But it's
okay, can't wait to hear about that.
And we're working on a new business right now, which is called Restaurant Kits. So with the success of the Venue Moo, we have seen that there's this potential. And what I sort of mentioned a minute ago, when we do open back up the restaurants in July or whenever that might be, we know that it's going to be tough, and it's going to be a fight, and we need this extra revenue stream. So we started a business where we can take our Mac and Wild kit, and it's going to be called Restaurant Kits. So we want to team up with good quality restaurants that want to do kits, but when you're focusing open a restaurant, you're not going to have the space to dispatch your whatever your kind of hero dish is, and B, you're not going to want, it's just the bandwidth is not going to be there. So what we're doing is we're taking on this kind of business to promote these kits and help with the production and kind of act like a bit of a Deliveroo of restaurant kits. So that's launching next week or the week after with 10 restaurants. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. So other than your own restaurants, in normal times, where do you love to eat?
What do you mean? Doing restaurants?
Is it fine dining or is it burger joints?
Do you know, I've not been for a fine dining restaurant in a long time. I do love it though. I love the pretense and the service that you get around it. But to be honest, I like quality foods and well cooked foods more than anything. So places like, I live in Southeast London, so places like the Camberwell Arms is a big favourite of mine. That's in Camberwell, funny enough. And Artuzzi is in a little Italian place in Peckham. It's amazing. What I really miss are the local kind of local restaurants, just going to somewhere local and having a bite to eat and coming, maybe a beer and then coming home.
So is there anything that you won't eat?
Oh, right. Anything I won't eat? I've eaten some weird and wonderful things. I think when I say things, I don't believe in eating meat that comes from other countries. I try not to eat meat if I don't know where it comes from. And that's not just saying where it comes from as in the geographic location. Like, I really don't like eating things unless I actually know the farm or the farmer.
Right.
So that's something I try and stay true to. I remember going to a restaurant called Picnic, a little French kind of chicken restaurant in Bermondsey, and there was a tasting menu which I just thought was so hilarious, or like ironic. They had a kind of a chicken tasting menu, but they had one bit which the first course was this amazing like chicken liver parfait on some French bread, and I was like, oh, this is insane. Second course was a chicken consommé with a little like stick over the top, and this person comes up and says, "This is," and they picked up my bowl and they picked up my stick and they went, "This is the art," and I was like, "The what? The heart?" And he went, "Yeah," and so they popped it in and it was the heart of the chicken. I was like, "All right, wow. Cool." And this is the peak, and it was the, you know, the bit on top of the chicken, the peak.
Yeah.
And this is the, and the next one, and he went, "This is the the gizzard," and I was like, "Gizzard." The gizzard is amazing. And then he says, "And this is the testicles." I was like, "What did you say?" It's like, "Testicles, obviously chicken," and I was like, "Wow!" And then, so I ate all the bits. I left the testicles, but then everyone I was with, they were like, "Come on, what's that?
Did you try them?"
I did eat them in the end, but I draw a line somewhere, and I think it's just before the testicles and the penis. I will always try anything once, sort of thing, but
I'm not a massive fan of beans. I don't know what it is. Beans and rice, it's the texture. But yeah, it's weird. I think it's only recently I've discovered that.
That's really funny you say that, because I'm with you on the beans, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to hate them as a kid. Yeah, I mean, well. So yeah, that's it pretty much.
Yeah. So I heard in normal times you're doing bespoke parties.
Yeah, so we do a few events where we'll rock up to people's houses and put on a big kind of theatrical fire pit feast, kind of like I was discussing earlier. And we do that, and then we can do the whole kind of shebang.
Yeah.
That's the catering and the service and things like that.
And you have a Land Rover gun bus. What's that?
Yeah, so we've got this huge 1990. So what's that? Is that 30 years old? What is 1990? Yeah, almost 30 years old. Oh no, it is 30 years old. Jesus. And so it's a, what is it? 3.2-liter V8 engine in it. So it's an absolute beast. But it's a huge, it's a 130. So it's a big long wheelbase Land Rover. And it's just beautiful. Like the engine just sounds amazing. And we try and set our barbecue fire pit feast kind of around it. So it's just a nice backdrop. Excuse me. Yeah, and then we generally, if it's a small party, we'll invite people into the back of the Land Rover for the first course. So it'll be cocktails and scallops or something like that, and then you know, venison tartare. Jump back out of the Land Rover, sit on a nice long table, and have like four or five courses of everything cooked on the fire. It's really cool, and we do it in weird and wonderful locations. So tops of mountains, by the river, wow. at the sea. But yeah, really really fun.
That sounds awesome. So, do you wear a sporran in the kitchen?
No, that's a really funny question, because I used to, and then so I take it off, because I wear my kilt quite a lot for cooking, for day to day life. I love wearing my kilt, right. but the sporran gets in the way. And also, when you put the apron on, it just looks a bit suspect when you've got this big bulge under your apron and. I take the sporran off.
Yeah, okay. I understand the reason why, so that's fair enough. So, Andy, tell me something about yourself that I couldn't possibly know.
I'm just not that exciting a person. One of my biggest achievements, I think, is when I was seven, I won a bravery award from the police. I don't know, it was five or seven. Won a bravery award for catching these two robbers that had escaped. Yeah, they'd broken out of prison. Classic story. Broken out of prison, kidnapped a taxi driver, and then they were held up in the woods next to where I was from, where I lived. And I found them, told the police, and they got caught and put back to prison. And then weirdly, actually, I'd forgotten about this. One of the guys, they went to prison. One of the guys then became a butcher for my dad, like when I was 20, and I had to work with him. And I didn't find out. And I was like, holy shit, like what? This guy's gonna, what's he gonna do?
Did he know you were cool?
I'm not sure. I never really kind of, I didn't want to bring it up in conversation, but he was a really, really nice guy and completely like, yeah, that was a lifetime ago for him. So. But yeah, that's quite, I'm not sure many people know that story.
So on that note, Andy, we've kept you on for quite a while. Thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. And guys, if you want to follow Andy on Instagram, he's on Andy War, Mac and Wild, and I'm at Posh Nosh Girl. Thanks, Andy. Take care and see you soon.
Bye.